There are people in your life, and you know them, who make you different just by your being around them. It might be a teacher, maybe even one of the ones who stood in this room just a minute ago. It's the teacher who cares deeply about his or her subject matter and it rubs off on you, or you watch the way that teacher treats the kid that everyone else is unkind to. You feel the inspiration coming from this person, even if it's not directly aimed at you. Maybe it's a coach or a group director, like a choir or band or orchestra or other group that you might belong to. And it's not just their mastery of that area. It's the way they lead, the way they inspire confidence, the way they bring out something in you that you didn't know you had. And you're different because just your time being around them. Could be a colleague. You watch the way they show up and work with excellence. You watch the way they run their world and get things done. You see the way they include others that might be left out. Maybe it's a friend that you have at school or at work or in other parts of your life. And you hear their music and movie taste and you start adopting some of those. You take on their sense of humor just because you spent time around them. It might be a family member. And someone who's known you a long time and known generations of your family says to you one day, "You know, the way you say that sounds just like your mom, just like your dad." And you think to yourself, "Oh, yeah, I guess I do." And then you're not sure what to do with that sometimes. People leave residue in our lives. All those relationships stick with us, even after we've made transitions in life. Maybe you hear a song and you're 22 again because an old boyfriend or girlfriend introduced you to that band. Or you run meetings a certain way because some colleague or boss 3 jobs ago did it like that. Or you treat people a certain way because you watched a friend do it in a different era of your life. Now, we know it works the other direction, too. Some people rub off on us in ways that we wish they hadn't. If you spend enough time around a cynic, cynicism starts sounding pretty reasonable. Or somebody treats everything like a competition, and what do you know, you're keeping score in all of your life as well. Or somebody's always outraged, and pretty soon you're carrying around anger that didn't even start with you. That's what relationships do. People participate in who we become. And you spend enough time around others, and it shapes you in ways you know and don't know. Today we're continuing this series we started last week called The People We Become. And in our text today, Romans 12, Paul has just finished with what I think is one of the most complicated sections of the entire letter, maybe even of Scripture. For 3 chapters, he's been wrestling with all these questions about Israel and the Gentiles and God's promises and God's faithfulness, and his answers, to me, aren't always simple. But I know this, by the end of chapter 11, Paul arrives somewhere. He arrives at mercy. Chapter 11, verse 32. "For God has bound everyone over to disobedience so that he may have mercy on them all." Jew and Gentile, insider and outsider, everyone standing in need of mercy. And Paul is so overwhelmed by this that he starts worshiping. The very next verse, "Oh, the depth and the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God." And now we get to chapter 12. The first verse, Paul says this, "Therefore, in light of everything we just said, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy." So there's the pivot. He spent all these chapters telling us what God has done. Now he's going to ask, what kind of people do we become in light of God's mercy? Here's the passage. We know it, we quote it, we love it. "Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Now, notice where Paul goes now for renewing minds. It's not going to be a list of mental exercises. It's not quiet time or journaling or small group discussions. He starts talking about how they live with other people. He gives them a dose of humility. Do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, he says. Okay. And now he's going to say, you're not even being transformed by yourself. You belong to each other. Verse 5, in Christ, we, though many, form one body, and each member belongs to all the others. Now Paul is going to start showing us what being transformed really looks like. He starts another section almost abruptly. Love must be sincere. Literally, he's saying love without hypocrisy. And then we get this torrent of verbs. Abhor or hate evil. Cling to good. Honor one another. Serve one another. Rejoice with one another. Endure with one another. Pray with one another. Share with one another. Welcome one another. Paul doesn't spend a lot of time telling us what love is or what it feels like. He gives us verbs. These are practices. You don't become hospitable by agreeing that hospitality is good. You open a door and pull up a chair at a table. You don't become generous by admiring generosity. You give and share. You don't become somebody who honors others by believing humility is a virtue. You actually give honor. The virtues show up in all of these verbs. Now let's keep going. Verse 14, bless those who persecute you. Okay, time out, Paul. We've changed categories. I thought we were talking about the church. He keeps going. Don't repay anyone for evil. As far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. And then he says, if your enemy is hungry, enemy, Paul, you started this paragraph by talking about how Christians treat one another. And somehow by the end, you're telling us how to feed an enemy. We normally think that the goal of these one another commands is the health of the Christian community. If you honor one another, you have a healthier church. If you share with one another, then other believers' needs get met. If you practice hospitality, people feel like they belong among God's people. If you rejoice and mourn together, then believers don't walk alone in the high and low points of life. That's true. But what if something else is happening at the same time? Every time I practice these one another things toward you, my fellow Christian, I'm becoming someone capable of doing them in other places. That's why this progression from one another to the enemy makes sense. Maybe one another isn't the finish line. Maybe one another is where we practice. The theologian Stanley Hauerwas, who taught many years at Duke, had a poster hanging on his office door. The heading was A Modest Proposal for Peace, and the text read this, like this. Let the Christians of the world agree that they will not kill each other. And you think, well, that's not much of a proposal until you remember history. Think about how many battlefields have had Christians on both sides. Sometimes over religion itself, sometimes over land or power or national borders. Sometimes it was Christians on both sides in the same country praying to the same God for victory over the other. And then the modest proposal doesn't sound quite so modest, does it? And then you think of Paul's commands. It's pretty hard to honor one another or be devoted to one another, or serve one another. And we can't even agree that we won't kill one another. Now, of course, Hauerwas wanted Christians to imagine something bigger than just not killing each other, but his point was, you got to start somewhere. That's what Paul is doing here. He starts with one another. Honor one another and share with one another. Rejoice with one another. Weep with one another. Practice the way of Jesus here. Practice it among these people. Because eventually Paul is going to ask us to take it on the road. What would it look like to practice peace and become really good at it and then take it on the road? What would it look like to practice honoring one another, be expert level at it, and then take it out for a spin beyond the church? What would it look like to practice hospitality with one another, get ninja level good at it, and take that beyond the walls? And what would it look like to practice loving one another and take that out for a test drive in the world? What happens if church becomes a place where we learn to love? Now, that doesn't assume that everyone is always easy to love all the time. I get that. But I think among all of us, peculiar, irritating, delightful, needy, generous, and opinionated people, I learned to practice honoring and sharing and welcoming and rejoicing and weeping and forgiving. And then one day I encounter somebody who is not one of us, who is not like one of us, someone who dislikes me or has actually harmed me, and I learn something. Those habits come with me. Many of you have heard of John Lewis, civil rights hero, member of Congress. But before he was doing all that, he was a college student in Nashville. And when he was there, he became involved with a minister named James Lawson. He was training these college students in nonviolent resistance. And I do mean training. They would meet on Tuesday nights at a church in Nashville, and they would practice what was going to happen when they started sitting down at those lunch counters. Some of them would play the protesters sitting in. Some of them would play the angry people. And they would yell at each other and insult each other and taunt each other, push each other around. And if you were playing one of those sitting at the counter, you practiced how you would respond. What are you going to do when someone gets right in your face? What are you going to do when someone shoves you or calls you something awful? And in those Tuesday meetings, they practiced it at church. Now, years later, we see all the famous pictures of Lewis on the bridge. We know about the march and the beatings that he took. And you look at that kind of nonviolence and you think, how does somebody do that? Well, part of the answer is he didn't start practicing when someone hit him. He'd been practicing on Tuesday nights at church. Now, what they did in those workshops was not the same as what they endured, but they were developing habits. They practiced how not to let someone else's hatred determine their response. And then when the stakes got higher, those habits went with them. I think that's what Paul is imagining for the church. We practice on one another. Maybe not in those ways, but in the ways that happen in our lives. I know most Sundays the stakes are pretty low. Maybe somebody annoys you or disagrees with you or they disappoint you or they need something from you. But we get another chance to practice. Because you don't suddenly become a different kind of person when the stakes are high. You bring with you the person you've been practicing becoming. Paul closes this section by telling us this: Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. What does it mean to be overcome by evil? We might assume that evil wins because it harms me. But there may be something more at work here. Evil wins because it harms me and then recruits me. They become contemptuous toward me. Well, I will become contemptuous toward them. They humiliate me. I'll take an opportunity to humiliate them. They caricature me. I'll caricature them. They stop seeing my humanity. You know what? One day I'll stop seeing theirs. And then the thing that I hated in them has reproduced itself in me. That's overcome by evil. That's why Paul's commands feel defiant. Bless and feed and give drink and practice hospitality and don't retaliate. It's not like Paul is saying that what they did to you doesn't matter. He's not saying Christians are doormats. He's not saying that evil isn't evil. He begins with hate what is evil. He knows there's evil. But Paul is saying, you don't get to decide who I become, who we become. He's saying that you prepare for the extraordinary moments in extraordinarily boring ways. You probably don't become someone capable of blessing an enemy by waiting until you have one. You become that person when someone else gets the recognition and you honor them. You probably don't become someone capable of loving people who see the world different from you when the disagreement is about something enormous. You probably become that person in Bible class when someone interprets a passage a little bit differently than you do, and you get curious instead of getting defensive. You probably don't become a person capable of resisting contempt when someone attacks everything you believe. You become that person when someone at church posts something on Facebook that makes you roll your eyes or makes your blood pressure rise a little bit. And you refuse to reduce a whole human being to the worst thing you've seen them say in a while. You probably don't become a person capable of living at peace with an enemy the first time someone genuinely wrongs you. You become that person when someone at church makes a decision you don't like, and you learn how to disagree without questioning character or motive. I don't think you become someone capable of loving across all the divisions that are tearing our world apart overnight. You become that person when someone 20 years older than you or 20 years younger than you says something you don't understand, and instead of dismissing them, you listen. And you probably don't become someone capable of giving good back when someone gives you pure evil. You become that person when someone at church irritates you, overlooks you, disappoints you, misunderstands you, and you keep practicing. You practice honor on one another. You practice generosity on one another. You practice hospitality on one another. We're going to need the practice, because there is plenty of contempt out there. You're going to see it all the time. It's going to recruit you every day. And so we come here among these delightful, joyous, irritating, disappointing human beings. And we practice. We practice until honor becomes instinct, until hospitality becomes instinct, until enduring with someone else becomes instinct. We practice on one another. And then one day, when someone comes at you and hands you pure evil out there, you will discover that after all these years of practicing on one another, that good is what you have learned to give back. May it be so in us. Let's stand and sing.